Hi, this is David Oliver from BipolarCentral.com, and I have on the line with me Carl. Carl is actually an author, and he has done tremendous with bipolar disorder. He's going to be talking about his experiences with bipolar disorder, the ins and outs of how to manage it. He's going to be talking about his book. He's going to be giving a lot of great information that's really unique. You know, in the past, we've done some interviews with some authors, but this one is really going to be a great interview that's going to provide a lot of insight that you just don't really see in traditional books and information you don't get that's out there. With that said, Carl, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. Well, you know, the first thing that we love to start off with is we love to ask people if they could kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of who they are, where they're located, and how old they are, and what's their family situation.
Okay. Let's see. I am formerly an architect. I'm an artist and a writer. I guess I'm still an architect. There's no work for architects at the moment. I am 65 years old. I live in Pasadena, California. And what else can I tell you? What did I skip?
So are you married at all?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I have a wife of 21 years. And as a matter of fact, she has supported me through this whole thing and stuck by me through thick and thin, and my book is dedicated to her.
Great. Now, you have any kids?
Yes, I do. I have a daughter.
Okay.
She lives in London.
How old is she?
She's 31.
Okay, great. And you're out there in California?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And that you know, that's great because it, you know, kind of gets everyone oriented, you know, to your situation. So, you know, as you look back, when did you first have the first, you know, instances of bipolar behavior? Because obviously, I would suspect that you had some sort of symptoms that were exhibiting, but they didn't know it was bipolar, I would imagine.
No, they didn't. I would gather it probably started when I was in college. I would stay up all night writing papers and just being excited by the work I was doing, and then I would get severely depressed, and I attempted suicide when I was 20 years old.
Wow. Okay, so 20 years old, you attempted suicide. Now, let me ask you, too, because people always want to know this question. You know, did you do well in school?
I didn't do well my first time around in school until I actually had my incident and ended up in the hospital and came back and majored in art and architecture, and I went from the bottom of my class to the top of it.
Gotcha, okay. So now you attempted suicide, and what was done there? What did your parents say, and kind of what happened?
Let's see. I remember distinctly my parents put away my gun.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's, you know what? And I know you're laughing, but we really try to drive that point home.
Yeah.
That people need to be careful with those, you know, weapons of all sorts that,
yeah,
you might as well put them away.
Yeah, I had one of those repeating rifles, and I used to go target shooting as a kid when I was in the Explorer Scouts, and so that she hid it away. I remember that distinctly. I remember my father coming to the hospital to see me, and my confronting him for a lot of different reasons, and he never came again. So that was a kind of unfortunate circumstance. I had a not a terribly good experience my first time around in the mental hospital. The psychiatrist who was seeing me turned out to be nuttier than me. He was stealing typewriters from the university, and he had something like 300 typewriters in his apartment. And one day he disappeared, you know, and I read out in the Daily News. And that actually turned me off of the whole idea of psychiatry for a long, long time.
You know, I don't mean to laugh, but it's just kind of funny because, you know, when a lot of these psychiatrists, it's not all of them, of course. Some of them are, they're totally out of their mind.
Yes, they are.
I mean, I've heard so many stories over the years.
Well, I think mine's a pretty good one.
The typewriter thing.
Where did the psychiatrist go? Well, he's in the mental hospital now.
For stealing typewriters.
For stealing typewriters. He had a typewriter fetish.
So, now, as you, after that person left, did you work with anybody else?
Sort of, you know, but, you know, I was really focused on getting out of the hospital. I decided that the way that you got out of the mental hospital is you played sane. So I attempted to do everything they told me and to act as sane as I could, even if I was feeling nutty. So I became under the impression that the way you were sane was to just play at it.
Right. Okay. Now, was that easy for you to do?
Not really, you know, but I did get out of the hospital fairly quickly and, you know, and then spent a year out of school and then came back, you know.
Now, what did your parents say about this?
You know, they weren't very communicative, unfortunately. I think in those days they were kind of, as I say, the first thing they did was put away the gun. They weren't really terribly supportive. My father wasn't supportive. You know, he didn't want to talk to me about it. You know, he was a very closed man. I think people of his generation were about this. This was something you didn't talk about and you didn't admit to, or, you know, things like this didn't happen in good families.
Right, and all those things you just said are absolutely not correct.
They're not correct?
Well, meaning bipolar can happen in a good family.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Yes, it can happen in any family.
Absolutely. Now, so as you move forward, I mean, it's a little odd that, you know, you attempted suicide and there really wasn't rigorous psychiatry or, you know, counseling or therapy?
Well, I went to see a shrink for a year after, you know, I got on the thing and I, you know, went to group therapy and all those things, you know, and, you know, I just, as I say, I thought that the way that you were saying was just to play it, you know, and so it really didn't take for me. I don't know how to put it.
Right, it makes sense. It just wasn't. It ultimately wasn't effective.
It wasn't effective.
Yeah. So okay. So now, you know, as you move forward, you know, as you moved into 25, 28, what was going on there?
Well, I had, you know, I was often, you know, up and down, and I couldn't quite figure out what was wrong with me. I remember, I'd kind of didn't like Freudian psychiatry because of what my experience was. I remember trying to find other kinds of therapy for my situation. You know, I went to a thing called Catherine Horner. I can't remember. I think that was her name. You know, her was a school of therapy in Chicago where I was living. And I would go to group therapies, but it, you know, honestly, it wasn't working. I wasn't taking any medication. I was simply going to therapy sessions. And I was still being afflicted by severe ups and downs.
So as you move forward, you know, into your 30s, what age did you hit where there was a change where for the positive? Or even a diagnosis? Because at this point, there was no diagnosis.
There was no I didn't get diagnosed for 30 years. You know,
okay.
Until I was in my 50s, I got diagnosed. As a matter of fact, what happened in my 30s was I got married and I had a daughter. My wife and I separated. I moved to Los Angeles and became an artist and lived in the art community. And then, you know, in art communities, the taking of drugs is kind of, you know, sort of par for the course. Everybody wants altered consciousness. So I became a heavy marijuana addict. And because I liked the pretty thoughts I had and how I could think circularly and think my way around any idea, you know, 360 degrees. But it was, and I think I was taking it partially self-medication at that time. But also what happened was that, you know, it elevated my moods from when I was depressed because I had all these wonderful thoughts. and it probably kept me up higher when I was manic. But then after a while it stopped working, and I would fall into these incredible periods of blackness. I used to call them the periods of the black brain, when I would just close up my studio, close the door, and go to bed for a week. And everybody noticed it but me, you know. My friends said, you know, something's weird with you, you know. And I said, I'm just fine. I'm just an artist, you know. I'm just an artist. It's just the way it is. One is wacky. And finally I went to get help from a psychologist, and he was called the artist psychologist, and he got me doing biofeedback and things like that, and he got me into meditation. And meditation proved to be a very good thing for me. I stopped smoking marijuana. I went back to my life as an architect. I had 7 years, and I was pretty stable. But what happened then was that I moved away from that. I stopped meditating, and I got into very stressful practice of architecture. I was running a firm of 24, 30 people with my wife, and it started to get to me, and I started having the severe ups and downs again. And what did I do? I started to try to self-medicate again, except this time marijuana didn't work. I went to something worse. I went to crack cocaine. And it, you know, crack cocaine is rocket fuel for a manic person. It just puts you really right up there and out there. And it also elevated the moods for a while. You know, so again, it was working, but it only works for not that long. And then it starts to be worse than anything. You know, you start to not get as high, you start to get lower. And that was my situation until I was addicted to crack for 8 years. I couldn't get off it. I tried every kind of program in the world to get off it. 12 Steps, Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, even Rational Therapy, I think it was called, Rational something or other, Rational Recovery, that was what it was called. Tried that. None of it, absolutely none of it worked, because it wasn't addressing the underlying problem of bipolar disorder. And it wasn't until I attempted suicide the second time at age 52, where I was going to go out and jump off a bridge, you know, into the freeway, because I just couldn't take life anymore. And it was actually, I was talked out of it by my own second voice. I don't know, I sort of feel that bipolar disorder is a conflict of two selves. And my second self talked me out of jumping over the bridge, saying, you don't want to do this, you're gonna kill yourself, which is fine, but you're gonna kill somebody else, who's an innocent person driving a car along the freeway. And I didn't jump. I put myself into the mental hospital the next day.
Interesting. Now, I have a bunch of questions on this. Where was your wife during this period?
Where was my wife? Well, she was putting up with me. You know, she was...
Because you separated, you became this artist.
No.
Not separated, but you moved...
No, she's my first wife I separated and divorced from.
Okay.
And when I got sober and I got had this period of remission of bipolar disorder, I got married the second time to my present wife.
That's okay.
20 years ago. But in my second collapse, you could call it, she stuck by me. Well, I don't know why. You know, she stuck until the very end. She said, you know, when I attempted suicide and was going to jump, she said, "I've had it. You've got to get some help, or I'm leaving you." And that's when I went and got help.
So let's drill down on a couple things. You found the psychologist. How did you find that person, and why did you trust them?
Why did I trust them? Well, I went to see him for a number of years, and he was recommended to me by others who had gone to see him and had you know, very successful relationship with him. And I had built this kind of trust with him. But he was a sort of psychologist, couldn't really prescribe drugs or anything. So the only thing he really could prescribe for me was meditation.
Right, I see. Now, and then you tried all different, you know, steps programs and drug programs, and that was after you had this period of stability, but then you started this practice which introduced a lot of stress.
Oh, enormous amount of stress. I mean, just trying to run an office of 24 people, trying to meet payroll, trying to get jobs. I don't know if you know anything about the architecture business, but it's a rough business because you're always going out and trying to get more jobs. And,
right.
You know, just, you know, and the ones you have, you got to try to do them so you don't lose money. You know, it's very, a lot of high pressure. And I buckled under it.
Right. And, a lot of people would. Now, then, you know, you got a situation where you're going to commit suicide again, but then you went to go get help, and you put yourself into the hospital.
Yes.
Now, what happened at the hospital?
Well, at first, I'd made this agreement that I would go into the hospital if they didn't put me in a locked ward. And when I got to the hospital, I sort of was sassy to a nurse. You know, I was a little bit sarcastic. And they ended up putting me in a locked ward, and I was so infuriated. I threatened my wife and my doctor, who I said I was going to kill them. I didn't really mean that, but that's what I said. And so the psychiatrist then put me in what they call a 5150 in California, where you're committed for a certain period of time because you're a danger to others and supposedly to yourself. I was so mad about this. And again, my thing, playing sane, came back to me. I had to play sane. So I played sane, and I was able to talk them out of this, putting me into the locked ward for 14 days. I was able to talk them out of this, and I was put back in the hospital. I had a choice of either leaving the hospital or not leaving the hospital. And I decided to stay in the hospital because I really needed help. I knew I needed help. I just didn't want to be in prison, you know.
Well, what is a locked ward for people who don't know what that is?
Well, that's where you can't get out. You can't get out beyond the door. You know, you're locked inside. You're restrained in your movement. And if you're really bad, they put you in straps. You know, so it's not a nice situation. You feel like you're in jail.
Right, I see. Okay, so you didn't want to be there. They put you there. But then you got out of there.
Yeah, I got out of there, and I got into the main hospital, and I came across this wonderful doctor. The first doctor I had who wanted to put me in there, I fired him. I said I didn't want him. I didn't like him. Didn't like him at all. And so they gave me this other doctor, and she's female, turned out to be so wonderful. And I tried to explain to her that I thought my problems of the mood swings and everything that I had were caused by my difficult childhood. Because I had a very difficult childhood. I was, put in a foster home, and a lot of things happened to me there. She said, well, all well and good. You may very well have had a difficult childhood, but the reason that you're the way you are is because you're bipolar and you have a chemical imbalance in your brain. And she said, now I want you to go look at, I've kept journals for 30 years. I've written down everything I think about, write about.
Now, why did you do that? Who told you to do that?
Who told me to write journal?
Yeah.
I just did it on my own. I started writing them when I was in Europe as a way of traveling around and recording what I saw in Europe. And then I just kept it up, writing about cities, books, how I felt about trying to find my mother after 30 years and things like this. What my moods were when I was feeling suicidal, when I was not feeling suicidal. So I went back through all these journals and looked through them to find the symptoms of bipolar disorder. Grandiosity, racing thoughts, periods without sleep, high-risk behavior, all those kinds of things. And I had all of them. And I said, my God, she's right. I'm bipolar, And so she put me on medication, and it was a miracle. It was a miracle, David. I all desire to use drugs, to use illegal drugs went away. my ups and downs were almost totally mitigated. They weren't completely. I mean, I still was having them, and I went back into the hospital about a year later for a tune-up, you know, as I was starting to have ups and downs again. And but
now, what's a tune-up for people who don't know what that means?
I was starting to feel a little suicidal. I was starting to feel a little. I was starting to have more manic and depressive episodes, and I decided to check myself back into the hospital again for basically a tune-up, just like your car.
Right. Okay. Great.
Analogy is a car analogy, just like you would take your car in for. You know, have the spark plugs replaced.
Now, someone listening to this might be thinking, and I know people are thinking, they're saying, man, you know, either a supporter saying, wow, that's really lucky because that guy just checks himself into the hospital when he's not feeling well. And why do you think you do versus other people who go for months, weeks, days, weeks, months, and sometimes years really in and out of reality and refuse to go to the hospital no matter what?
Well, I thought a lot about this, and I met a lot of bipolar people, and a lot of people feel that if you check yourself into a hospital, they're going to give you medication, number one, and that medication is going to make you not feel yourself. And it's true. You do. I first took this medication, I did not feel like Carl, what Carl used to be. And I liked Carl in some ways. He was, you know, he was an energetic, interesting person with a lot of edges, you know. It was an edgy, I'm an edgy person. I liked that. When I took all these meds, I became what I called a round rock. All the things that made me interesting got taken off, and I was just like all the round rocks next to the river. And I think this is the reason that a lot of people don't want to go, because they fear they're going to lose themselves. And you can, if you're not a good advocate for yourself, or if you don't have a good psychiatrist to help you. You've got to be able to go in and say, hey, you know, this is fine. I'm not having these terrible depressions anymore, but I don't feel like me, you know. And so what she and I did, and we've worked over the years, is getting the right medication for me that makes me don't have the super highs anymore. I don't have the super lows anymore. I'm pretty even, but I still have my creative energy. I still am interested in life. I'm not lethargic, you know. I'm out there. I'm fully engaged in life.
So how did you get to the right medication?
Trial and error.
What's that?
Trial and error.
Trial and error. And what would you say to people who think like you just said, where they're like, oh, I don't want to change, but I don't want to wait either? Like, what message, because there's a lot of people who will be reading and listening to this who have bipolar disorder who really will disagree, and they'll say, well, I don't want to be altered, and I don't want to take the time to wait. What would you say to them?
I would say that you're not having a good view of this. I would say that you have to, number one, give the medications a chance. You have to be proactive as a bipolar person. I mean, you just can't be passive in relationship to the psychiatrist and accept anything they give you. There are so many drugs out there today and so many different therapies that can help you that you don't have to end up losing who you are, or you can retain all of it and still have a healthy, interesting life.
You know, and some people, they don't really understand what you mean by advocate for yourself and don't be passive. Like, what do you mean? Can you give us some examples?
Sure, I can. You've got to go into the doctor and say, hey, you know, this medication you're giving me is making me feel very lethargic. It's making me get fat. It's making me not feel at all like myself. Please look at something else, you know. And there are lots of alternatives now. Either you change the dosage or you change the medication. I mean, we've got medications now that run all the way from lithium to Abilify to Lamictal to Risperdal. You know, there's just, you know, I take a cocktail of drugs now, and we've found it by trial and error, because each set of drugs doesn't work the same on any one person. They work differently.
That very well said, and you're right. I mean, what's some examples of with you where you had to advocate, like, for yourself, and then what was the before, what was the after?
Well, it was that myself was one, you know, and I had to say, this is not working, I don't feel like it, and we had to give up. I can't remember what the drug was. It might have been Depakote, but I had a lot of problem with anyway, because Depakote makes you gain weight like crazy. You know, if you're big, you become incredibly big. You know, I remember having Depakote and eating six enormous pork chops in the hospital, and I said, wait a minute, one meal, I ate six pork chops, and I wasn't even full. And I went to the doctor and said, this is impossible, I can't go on like this, you know. I'll be bigger than Jackie Gleason, you know. So you can't be passive, you know, even on the small stuff. And any kind of side effects you have, you've got to speak up about them.
Gotcha. And, you know, that's the number one problem that I find from my vantage point in all these years is people never say anything. They do one of two things. They either don't say a word, or they just get off their medication because they think, there's only one medication. You know, there's only one thing that this one thing didn't work, and that's it. I'm done.
Well, you know, I you can understand that. Also, a lot of psychiatrists are not open to listening to the patient. You know, they don't like it if the patient talks back. You know, I know this is especially true for people who are poor, you know, and get medication from agencies of some kind,
right?
You know, and they get assigned some psychiatrist, and it's not really their choice, you know. And they go in, and the guy doesn't want to listen to him, or the woman doesn't want to listen to him. You have to advocate. You have to say, I will not take this. Please find something that works for me, and you can. You can find it.
Exactly. So you did that, and, you know, things. The other thing is, why did you accept bipolar? So why did you accept it where you just didn't say, well, I don't have that, and go on a 10-year, I refuse to believe I have it, like some other people do?
Well, I mean, it was sort of incontrovertibly proved to me by my own writing, you know. My own journals proved it to me. You know, I could go back and look at journals I wrote about, you know, some really high-risk behavior that I was in. I could go back and see my cyclical attacks of the black brain that would happen about every 6 weeks, and I could track them. As a matter of fact, 1 year, I actually tracked a whole year in a daily diary, you know, those red books you get. I tracked the up and down, and I saw I had it every 6 weeks. I said, what's going on? You know, something's going on here. You know, I can't deny it. It's not deniable. You know, when you have the proof right in front of you, you know, you either close your eyes to it or you open it up and say, hey, this is true. This is me. And it was me.
Gotcha. Now, as you, after this, you went to the doctor, you got a good medication. So what year, how old were you when this was, were you about, you were like 50-something, right?
I was 50-something. I was 52.
Okay, 52. So now, what happened after that?
Things have really gotten a lot better. You know, well, I mean, I've had my ups and downs. I went back to the hospital and got a tune-up, as I told you. But since then, I've been pretty level. I go to see my psychiatrist once a month. We look at my meds, you know. We look at how I'm doing. And she says, you're doing great. And, you know, if I'm saying, well, I'm feeling a little depressed these days and a little down, she says, well, maybe we need to increase the amount of this you're taking for a while, you know, and let's see how that goes. Or maybe we'll add an antidepressant, and we just added one, and now we've taken it away, you know, because I'm doing really well. And so, you know, I don't think either that living on medication is necessarily a life sentence. You know, I think that, you know, I have started out taking a lot of medication, And over the years, it's sort of diminished. And I'm taking actually a pretty small amount these days.
So you've had really 13 solid good years.
Yeah.
And it really seems like the key was you embrace the diagnosis, you listen to the psychiatrist, you advocate for yourself, you follow the treatment plan.
Yeah.
And you avoid stress?
I try to avoid stress. I do indeed. I know that stressors are something for me. I mean, I have to watch out for what are my stressors or what are my signs that I'm getting a little wacky. For me, the key one is irritability. You know, and if I'm starting to get really irritated with people, I know I'm getting manic. If I start getting really irritated with things, I'm getting depressed. My wife just calls it the attack of the inanimate objects. When the door or the table is attacking me, you know, I know that I'm about to get depressed. And I have to watch for it. And if I do that, if I'm aware of it, and positive think, meditate, you know, get exercise, eat properly, I can mitigate it to some degree. You know, but you have to be, vigilance is the key.
Now, how did you, let's talk about, what do you think your wife, how was she able to deal with all this for 21 years?
With difficulty. She had to love me. She loved me. She loves me, and I love her. You know, and love, she was willing to see if I would get over it, if I would get help, you know. My first wife wasn't willing to put up with it, you know.
Why do you think? Just different makeup of her?
Different makeup, but I also didn't really know what was wrong with me then. And I was just kind of, you know, I would be nasty to her some days and nice to her another, you know. It was like I was two different people. And
right.
That's pretty hard to deal with, you know, for a lot of folks. Virginia, my present wife, decided she would stick with me. And has to do with her makeup. I guess she saw something within me worthwhile.
Right, I see. Now, what about your daughter? Now, how did you handle that?
Well, she didn't live with me. You know, she lived with her mom in San Francisco. And I very purposely tried to stay in her life. I would go and visit her once a month. You know, driving from Los Angeles to San Francisco once a month for 18 years.
Wow.
You know, because, first of all, because my mother disappeared from my life when I was 5 years old, and I never didn't know who she was. And I was determined against all things, and in spite of my marriage failing, I was going to keep up relationship with my daughter. And so she and I are very close now. You know, she knows about my condition.
How did you explain it to her? At what point?
I think she was in high school when I explained it to her. You know, and you know, she took it a little. She didn't take it exactly the right way then, but you know, I'm glad I did. And now, over the years, we've able to have good conversations about it, and you know, she's read my book and. She knows all about Dad's weirdness and crazy things that he's done, and she loves me.
That's great.
And I love her.
Now, what are some, you have any other tips on managing disorder that you'd like to share?
Well, I think the main thing for you to do is to watch what your triggers are and what those triggers are and what the signs are for bipolar for you. You know, like, as I say, irritability is a big one for me. Or all of a sudden if you're having racing thoughts. Or if you're all of a sudden going on a spendthrift thing. You know, I know one guy, when he gets manic, he goes out and buys a new car all the time. And, you know, and he has to watch out because he knows if he's got a desire to go out and buy a new car, you know, he's getting manic. So there, you know, vigilance and awareness is key. And awareness not only in part of the person who has the illness themselves, or the affliction, if you want to call it, or the condition, is that you know, those around you must be aware of it too.
Right.
And I'm lucky that whenever I get you know, start to get irritated and crazy. My wife says, have you taken your meds? Do you think you need to go see the psychiatrist again? Do you think you need an adjustment on your meds? You know, la, 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 you know.
Now, does that annoy you? Because for some people with bipolar disorder, that does annoy them.
I can't say that I always accept it with great diplomacy. You know? Sometimes I tell her to go to hell, you know. But usually I wake up and say, okay, you're right, you know. You know, I don't like being told things by people I don't like to hear. Nobody does, you know, but, you know, sometimes you have to hear it.
Now, as you, the other thing, what do you do to curtail stress?
Well, exercise, get plenty of sleep, do the things I love to do, which are writing and drawing and, you know, those kinds of things. They help me reduce stress. Walk my dog, you know. Those are all good things.
Very simple stuff. And the great thing is nothing that you're saying is like you have to be a rocket scientist to understand.
No, you don't. You know, having bipolar disorder is not rocket science. It's a pretty common thing. I mean, what we got, 5.6 million people in America with the disorder, maybe more. You know, that's
yeah, it's like it's got to be like 15, 17 million people in the U.S.
Yeah, it's a lot. And, you know, it's a common affliction. But, I'd also like to say one thing, that as much as it's a problem, it's also an advantage. You know, I feel that bipolar people in general are very sensitive, you know, and a lot of them are extremely creative. I think of myself as being extremely creative, and I think a lot of people who have that disorder, and, you know, writers and poets and artists and all have been afflicted with it, you know, and I think one of the reasons they're afraid of changing is they're afraid of losing that creativity, that advantage part of it, you know. It's amazing what you can do when you're manic, you know. I mean, you can stay up for days and create all kinds of things and accomplish a great deal. You know, the downside is, you know, there's the other side of the roller coaster when you're going down.
Right. Good point. Now, you know, so tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book sort of chronicles my 30 years of dealing with the disorder. It also deals with my search for my mother, who I didn't know for her name for 30 years, and who I thought was the source of all of my difficulties. And she may very well be, from the point of view of her genetic makeup, because she was a nightclub singer and she lived a kind of wild life as a young lady. And so I think I inherited her genes. My father doesn't seem to have those. But so my story is about trying to find her, but also it comes out, you know, because I thought my problems stemmed from that, it's a kind of complex weaving of looking at my journals and writing about them in the terms of the search I made for her and how it began to explore and expose all of the traits of bipolar disorder. So, and it also goes into my recovery, you know. I call it bipolar bear, because I'm bearing all, and my life's journey with mental disorder. And, you know, it's been a long and kind of a wild roller coaster ride.
And I highly recommend it. Where can people get it from?
Amazon.com.
But what's your website address?
www.bipolarbear, spelled B-A-R-E, book.com.
So again, that's www.bipolarbear, B-A-R-E, book.com.
Yes.
And it's available at Amazon.com. And it's what, again, give the title and then also your full name.
The title of the book is Bipolar Bear, My Life's Journey with Mental Disorders, a Memoir. And my name is Carlton Davis.
Great. Highly recommend people get it. Well, we're almost out of time. Was there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I think we've pretty well covered it. Anything else you'd like to ask me?
No, I mean, this is fantastic. I think the big takeaway that people should get is that it really is simple. A lot of people struggle for decades, but they really aren't doing, you know, they're not even doing half of what you've said today. And everything you've said today is very, very simple to do. It's not complicated.
Yeah, it's not complicated.
It's not like you've said, well, the reason why I'm doing well is because I do, you know, I run 30 miles a day, I stand on my head, I stand with one arm, you know, in the morning for 2 hours, and I do 52 different mathematical equations on, you know, that, you know, how to make my medication work. I mean, you have not said anything that people can't do themselves.
No.
And you really explain why people should embrace the disorder, why they should, you know, again, go to a doctor. They need to be on medication. And if you have problems, you have challenges, you know, you work, you advocate for yourself. If you have a problem with your psychiatrist, you vote with your feet, you find another one, because there's lots of options out there. And I think, you know, with yourself, too, the only thing you didn't really talk about was, I guess you, financially, you were able to, financially, you were able to work and take care of yourself financially, I guess.
Well, for most of my life, I was a working bipolar disorder person, you know. I mean, I would have these periods, but I also dropped out for a number of years and was an artist and used up every nickel I had, you know, and being in that life, and then, you know, lived on odd jobs for a number of years. And then when I got sort of back stable again, I worked for 7 years, and then I collapsed and I blew an enormous amount of money, you know, and basically if it weren't for my wife helping me out, I would have been on the street and homeless, you know. But, you know, I've never been rich. I've never had an enormous deep pocket. I've just been lucky, you know, and I've had support. I've had help.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I encourage everyone to get the book. It's available at Amazon.com, The Bipolar Bear, thebipolarbear.com. And, Carl, thank you very much for your time. This has been a fantastic interview.
Well, thank you, David. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad I was able to participate and help.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.